Okay. So if you look at how many minerals there are on Earth, and you compare it to the number of minerals on other planetary bodies, the question is, why are there so many more minerals on Earth than, you know, other bodies like the Moon and Mars and Venus and so forth? And so this is a question that a lot of people are interested in, and I'm getting this mainly from Robert Hazen in his book in 2003. And basically, he comes to the conclusion, and he's done a lot of active research in this area, that the big difference is life. And so Robert, being trained as a classic mineralogist, and back in the days when I had mineralogy, and he talks about this too, is inorganic chemistry. But if you look at the interactions of life, especially if you include the oxygen that's been emitted into the atmosphere as a result of photosynthesis, then life has a very big impact on mineralogy. Well, when I was reading his book, I thought, you know, the same is true, is even more true with soils. And but this is nothing new. Here's a paper written by Roy Simonson, and basically he is revisiting things that Dokuchev said in 1898, as quoted by Glinka, at the first Congress of Soil Science, where one of the most interesting disciplines is the theory between live and dead nature, or we would say between the biotic and the abiotic, or inorganic. So these ideas have intrigued soil scientists and other scientists for a long time. And so now, you know, we have the biological and geological coming together, as in the geobiological. And we know that, you know, pick a place on the Earth, and the different soils are the result of this triad, that you have factors coming together in different proportions to create processes that in turn create properties. But if you look at, okay, where's the evidence of life on soils? Well, you know, when you go to the boreal forest or even the deserts. And this is really the reason I'm interested in this area, is because a lot of the carbonates that we see are biomineralized. They're the result of microbial biomineralization, and at different scales, and even up to the ecological scale. Whenever you take out biology in the driest deserts of the world, you really drop, and even in some cases totally remove, the carbonates in the soil. And of course, organic matter is the obvious one. But even if you look at a profile like this, you can imagine that it has an impact of life, because at one time there would have been an O horizon and an A horizon. And it's not there because of another life form, human beings and land use. So if you just think of this idea of, okay, how is life affecting soils and how does soil affect life? And this is just a, you know, at the profile scale, looking at those interactions. But basically, this is what we're looking at, this coevolution, how they affect each other. Of course, life is impacted by soil, by nutrients. And I teach an introductory environmental science class, and all the students get that they got to have calcium. And you say, well, where's calcium come? Well, milk. Well, where do cows get the milk? Well, grass. Well, how does it get into the grass? Well, it takes it up from the soil. And where was it before that? Well, it was in rocks. So, you know, they really see that clear link. And, of course, you know, habitat, water storage, and even, you know, at a very distant and broad and abstract scale, the template-assisted biomolecule synthesis. In other words, clay minerals acting as templates upon which organic molecules may have organized themselves. But if you just look at habitat, for example, a lot of animals live in soil, and a lot of microbes live in soil. And so life is greatly accelerating the soil evolution, the mineral dissolution, by biogeochemical weathering, for example, organic acid, chelates, plus the nutrient uptake by plants and the microbial metabolism that's causing oxidation reduction, but also physical, as in burrowing animals and root expansion. And then if we go to from the profile to the landscape scale, ground cover is huge in the sense that whenever there is bare ground, there is a lot of erosion. And especially if you have, you know, periodic rainstorms to move things around. And that's not necessarily the case once you have a good turf, a good cover that holds the soil in place. Very different situation. So what I'd like to do then is, thinking about how soil affects life and life affects soil, is to look back into the past and then start marching forward. So if we look at the age of the earth in billions of years and start marching forward, of course, we have the formation of the earth about 4.57 billion years ago, and then soon after that, it's the formation of the moon, and I had to put that here because not a lot of soil formation during this time. Okay, gigantic collision, and it's probably responsible for the formation of the moon, this collision. But then you go still fairly early on in the Hadean to Black Earth, as Robert Hazen refers to it, and also David Christian in his book on time maps, looking at big history. But Black Earth, so a lot of basalt, a lot of molten, a lot of hot, not soil as we typically think of it today, but soon after, because of the volatiles that were being emitted by volcanoes and, you know, all the water and the carbon dioxide, but especially the water that was being emitted by volcanoes and its condensation, we get a blue earth, a shallow blue earth, but nevertheless, a blue earth. So probably not a lot of soils, unless you talk to the folks that are in subaqueous soils, and they might say, yeah, there's, you know, what are you talking about in those soils? But then by the time we get to gray earth, okay, so there's been enough lithologic differentiation that now you have, more silicate-rich granitic material that actually floats. And so you have these big granitic rafts. And at that point, I think we could say that we have soil formation. We have, the feldspars, and there would have been lots of water, a lot of CO2 to give rise to acidity, and probably the formation of kaolinite. And not only that, in the low-lying areas, there'd probably be, what today we'd call playas with evaporites, halite and so forth, and probably even gibbsite formation and other hydroxides of aluminum. Then, what's really interesting is how early life began. The paleontologists look at this having begun early, still in the Hadean, but under anoxic conditions. And so where the other categories had a beginning and an ending, this is still going with us today. And that's a very important point, I think. If there are still anoxic conditions and there are still the very similar microbes that appear to be the first microbes, the chemoautotrophs, and their impact on sulfur and iron, manganese, and nitrogen, the prokaryotes, both bacteria and archaea. But the point is that they're still important, and we still find these microbes doing what they've probably been doing for billions of years. And but it was when the photoautotrophs, when the cyanobacteria invented photosynthesis, that things really started changing mineralogically and in terms of soil formation, the cyanobacteria. And of course, the famous ones are the stromatolites in water that are emitting oxygen. And of course, there are beautiful fossils of this going back through time. But also, there are a lot of cyanobacteria in soil, and they're just a little hard to see. But if you have a system like these gypsum dunes that, is a homogeneous and doesn't have a lot of vegetation, it really simplifies things. And you can, still today see cyanobacteria, a little bit below the land surface, out of the ultraviolet, but still carrying on photosynthesis, releasing oxygen into the air. And so, oxygen being emitted by photosynthesis, but a lot of it was dissolving in the ocean, and all of that reduced iron in the ocean was oxidizing, was precipitating out as hematite and forming the great banded iron formations. They're so important for the as an ore for iron. And so you can imagine this, you know, process going on literally for you know, many millions of years, but being soaked up by the ocean, but not all of it. Because on soil, I mean, in the soil, you had reduced iron. And so, you know, given the exposure to oxygen, it would have, you know, oxidized to hematite and other oxides, goethite, magnemite, and so forth, even manganese being oxidized. And an example of this, a modern example, would be where near where I live in New Mexico, you get these really red soils, and these really stand out in remote sensing, very, you know, brilliant red, but mainly they're quartz. And if you run an XRD on these, you get, you know, primarily quartz peaks. But if you do thin sections, you see these very argillans that that are only microns thick, but still oxidize and give the landscape its red color. If you go back in time, you can find many contacts where there was subaerial exposure during the Precambrian pedogenic formation. Get these Precambrian paleosols where you can see, again, oxidation having taken place, spheroidal weathering, and so forth. Beautiful, but probably not much in terms of vegetation, except maybe some soil biological crust, but even then it would have to be subterranean because of the high ultraviolet at that point. Then toward the end of the Proterozoic, here come the eukaryotes. So now there are organelles, and the eukaryotes, you know, the oldest ones being fossil algae that are seen in chirps, but they do give rise to the biggest organisms on Earth, as in fungi and the fungal hyphae that are subterranean, but are very critically important for soils today and probably for soils back then. But as oxygen increases and increases and increases through time and finally reduces most of the iron in the ocean, it starts accumulating to the point that there's a stratospheric ozone filter. And that's real important for terrestrial life. And here's an example. It's the you've got two curves here. One's red showing the temperature, but the other one is the ozone concentration in the stratosphere that's real important for filtering out the UV, and that enabled then terrestrial plants to colonize the land. So probably there was subterranean life in the soils before this time, but now you have vascular plants, they're carrying on photosynthesis, they're bringing a lot of carbon into the system, which is fueling, you know, all of the heterotrophs in the environment. And definitely by the Silurian, this was the case. But some people say even in the Ordovician, you might have had some terrestrial plants. But definitely by the Silurian, and without a doubt, clear evidence for terrestrial plants in the Devonian. And Ron Blakey at Northern Arizona University put these paleogeographic maps together, and he would endow these with, you know, probably where vegetation was, you know, inferring where the vegetation was, where the deserts were. And we know that the deserts today are 30 degrees latitude. So, you know, it's speculative that probably we had deserts at 30 degrees. In the equator, you had tropical vegetation. And then during the Mississippian, a lot of photosynthesis going on that we're burning today. And, of course, we're interested in carbon sequestration today in large part because of what we're burning. And then this gives rise to different oxygen concentrations, especially in the Pennsylvanian. And But as we move through time, and you look at Pangaea, for example, you can see these huge deserts that were taking place. You can see where you had the more abundant vegetation. And by the time you get to the early Jurassic, I would think that the soils, or at least some of the soils that we know today, the oxisols, the aridisols, the alfisols, and then the temperate, you know, northern zones, and even the spodosols in the high latitude boreal areas were probably, you know, taking place. Then this would have been the landscape during the dinosaur extinction. And by the Eocene, the orders that we recognize today probably existed on this landscape, with the exception, maybe, of mollisols. But by the time you hit the Miocene, now you've got the grasses, and so you're generating the Molochepipedon, as we talk about it today, in classification. And then here we are today in the present. So after terrestrial life, there was another big event that happened, and this may be where I overlap with David Montgomery a little bit, is the agrarian civilizations. Okay, so if you have hunter and gatherers walking on the land surface and hunting things, probably not much impact on soils. They managed the ecosystem, no doubt, primarily with fire, but still, they're on the surface. But whenever you get to the agrarian civilizations, so now we're talking 12,000, 10,000 years ago in the Middle East, we're looking at the Tigris and Euphrates, and then a little bit later in the Nile, and then a few thousand years after that in the Indus, and then in China, and by the time you get to the New World, 6,000 years ago, we've got agriculture in the Americas. And the thing about this time period is we're plowing. We're actually turning over, we're bioturbating the soil. And there's an intensification, of course, the development of cities and civilizations, but also now there is an extensification of spreading across the landscape when now you're plowing. And but still, it was a period of muscle power, whether it was beast burden or human muscle power that was affecting this. And here's a quotation or a paraphrase from Will and Ariel Durant, one of their books, and said, "The Industrial Revolution, with all of its complexities, can be distilled down to this: the replacement of muscle power by machine power." And so once you hit that, now you can really plow a lot of soils. And probably you say, okay, well, how did this affect soils? Probably the two biggest ways. Number one, erosion, obviously. But number two, almost every example that you can have of looking at carbon in soil, if you take it from a native vegetative state to a crop state, organic matter goes down. Okay? And so that was a big impact. And if you look, here's a really interesting map, I think, by Ellis and all. And it's showing the wildlands on Earth. And number one, they're in cold areas. Or number two, they're in hot, dry areas, as in the Sahara. Or number three, they're in areas with high water tables. Or number four, real rugged areas, like the Rocky Mountains. You know, just real rough, rocky terrain. Still, what they categorize as the wildlands. And then you've got the semi-natural, and you've got the rangelands. And some people would argue the rangelands, in part, are wild, and some of them are. Some of them are overgrazed, and a lot of erosion taking place. And then the dense settlement areas, and then the crop areas. Okay, but human beings now, as a form of life, affecting soil. Then we got to hit another big period, and that's the industrial agriculture. And industrial agriculture, fossil fuel. And so it's really interesting at this meeting, looking back through time, a lot of this science has been developed at us. People coming to this meeting, and it's been very successful in a lot of ways. And so now there's just massive amounts of material moving across the earth from continent to continent. And some people would say that if you wanted to talk about successful scientific disciplines, you'd have to put agronomy in there in the 20th century. Of course, physics and computer science, so there would be a lot of them, but definitely agronomy in terms of being able to increase crop growth. This is a figure basically that pins on 1960 and shows the black line would be the world population. But except for the roots and tubers, everything has increased with time. And so the earth today has a lot of food. I mean, there are still people starving, no question about that. But it's not because there isn't enough food. It's more of a distribution thing. So industrial agriculture, tremendous in terms of increasing food production. But on the other hand, this is a NOAA image looking at the sources of nitrogen and phosphorus linked to the Gulf of Mexico dead zone. So there are definitely consequences. And, of course, we've got the mass extinctions that are occurring today. And so that really brings us to the Anthropocene. And whether or not we want to say that we are in the Anthropocene, and whether or not it's a formal time unit. GSA in 2011 had a session on the Anthropocene. And it was a big, session like this, bigger. And so the moderators at the end, when you had people, pros and cons, said, let's have a show of hands. How many people are in favor of a formal time zone, the Anthropocene, because it, captures the imagination, not only of the public, but of scientists. And half the hands went up, pretty much. Said, who's opposed to it? Because what kind of index fossil are you going to have? And are we really talking about something that would last millions of years? And all the technical stratigraphy. Who's opposed to it? Half the hands went up. So it's really quite the interesting time period. But if we say something about the Anthropocene, it's got to have human population in here. And if you were to expand the x-axis right there. So and I'll just put these dates because in terms of soils, whenever Dobrychev was making his statement, there was 1.5 billion people. When Hans Jenny, 1941, published Factors of Soil Formation, there's 2.2 billion people on Earth. And then now here we are, and there's at least 7 billion people that are here. So anyway, that's looking back, but we can also speculate about the future. And so what's interesting about this is there are young graduate students and young people just starting their career. And if we look at 2050, that's 35 years from now. And these guys, a lot of them still be going strong. And what's really interesting is of these three projections by the UN about population growth, these guys will be able to say, yeah, we hit 10.5 billion, or no, it's 9.5, or it actually, hit an inflection point at 8 billion people. So, and then what kind of issues will you be talking about? If we go 35 years back or 40 years back in terms of soil science, and had this discussion with, say, Guy Smith, and said, in 35 years from now, they're going to be talking about carbon sequestration. What? Carbon sequestration? I mean, things could really change, a lot. So, but it's an interesting time in terms of the interaction of life and soils, both in the past and for the future. Okay, thank you. After. Okay.